Well, I'll tell you what. If we're going to do tap-taps, I want to have a quorum. We will recess the House Committee. Call people. Call the House Committee on Audit and Human Service Budget Reform to order. We have some perfunctory technical measures to go through, and since we have a chair here of another committee that has a high degree of proficiency, I will pass the gavel and allow him to astound you as we open and close public hearings on a number of bills. Representative Cruz.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Open public hearing on House Bill 2537. Close public hearing on House Bill 2537. Open public hearing on House Bill 2559. Close public hearing on House Bill 2559. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2560. Close public hearing on House Bill 2560. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2641. Close public hearing on House Bill 2641. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2562. Close public hearing on House Bill 2562. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2829. Close public hearing on House Bill 2829. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2189. Close public hearing on House Bill 2189. You should have seen me last Friday in my committee.
He had, I mean, must have been 75 bills.
Yeah.
And I mean, just machine gun. It was very impressive, as was this performance. Representative Bates.
I would note that Obi may be in trouble.
Yeah, we are thinking about auditioning him.
It's a job that pays better than this. So, mm-hmm.
It's a consideration.
Yeah. If you want to make an honest living.
Yeah. Okay, we have closed our public hearing, and we are now returning to our informational meeting format, invited testimony only. Please, everyone note that this committee runs from 3:27. To 6 p.m. And to begin with, we're very pleased to have the folks from Mercer. But to set the context for the Mercer project and the introduction of the Mercer panel, we'd like to call to the witness stand Dr. Bruce Goldberg from Hooper. Enter and sign in, please.
And he's breaking things already.
Good afternoon. For the record, Bruce Goldberg from the Office of Health Policy and Research. Good afternoon, Chair Westland and committee members. What I wanted to do was just take a moment to provide the background and context for the rest of the information that you'll hear this afternoon. As part of House Bill 2519, there was a request to look at alternative methods of payment and capitation in the Oregon Health Plan. In order to carry that out, our office used some funding from the Robert Wood Johnson State Coverage Initiatives to seek some expertise as to how to best pay for and look at alternate methods of to capitation for Oregon Health Plan recipients. We, at that time, there was a a lawsuit in front against OMAP looking at the adequacy of capitation rates. As such, the report really doesn't address the adequacy of capitation rates, but really looks at how to pay and how to contract for services. So what you'll hear is some work looking at various methods to pay for and contract for services, but there really wasn't any work done around the adequacy of capitation. The process was that a RFP was put out to bid. We were fortunate enough to have three recipients who bid on the contract. It was eventually awarded to the group from Mercer, who you'll hear from momentarily. We had a series of background meetings, three background meetings, which were held well attended, at which contractors, hospitals, physicians, a variety of people from the industry attended. They gave some input into the issues that they felt would be important for the group to look at. The work by the Mercer Group began in November of 2002, and what you'll hear today is a summary of their report. And so, without any further ado, what I'd like to do is introduce James Matheson and Stephanie Davis and Steve Schramm from Mercer, who will be presenting you with their findings, and then hopefully there'll be some discussion and some response from some of the contractors.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Enter and sign in, please. Who's ever the tallest has to sit on the left, because those are the two smallest ORS books. You have to get real friendly with these microphones. This part of the building hasn't been remodeled yet. That's one of the reasons we're here. We like old-fashioned folks.
Haven't remodeled yet either.
Well, you reach a point of diminishing return on some makes and models, Representative Greenleg. So
just scrap it.
It's one of those, you know, high cost of health care at the beginning and at the end. Enter and sign in, please. Thank you.
For the record, I'm James Matheson from Mercer Human Resource Consulting.
Okay.
I was the lead consultant for the project that created the report to the Office of Health Policy and Research, Chair Westland, and members of the committee. I guess we could all sign in now, Stephanie.
Sure.
Chairman Westland, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Davis. I'm a senior consultant with Mercer.
Okay.
Chair Westland, for the record, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Schramm. I'm a senior strategist for Mercer's Government Human Services Practice.
Great. See you ahead.
Thank you, Chair Westland. I'm going to work from a set of slides that you should have in front of you. It's about two pieces of paper. The slides are numbered. The pages are numbered. I'll try and make sure I start at the beginning and go to the end, but if I jump around, I'll try and tell you.
Okay.
I wanted to start with just a little bit of a background on the report and our approach to it. We began, of course, by responding to the RFP. We were happy to receive the award and started out by reviewing a lot of materials, including notes from the background meetings that Bruce mentioned. We then did about a dozen interviews with key stakeholders from plans, providers, the legislative, the administrative, OMAP folks, and the actuary, current actuary for the Oregon Health Plan. We convened sort of a strategy or design session and came up with probably 30 components of possible alternatives to consider, and then worked to refine those into the six alternatives that show up in our final report. Along the way, we produced a preliminary report and had a public meeting with a bunch of the same people from those background meetings, a bunch of stakeholders, who gave us some feedback and helped us to craft our final set of options. Our study focus was, by the direction of House Bill 2519, focused on alternative ways to pay plans and providers. And we specifically did not focus as much on whether current funding was adequate or on the details of the current methodology. So in short, we were really thinking about financial structures of payment. The allocation of the risk, the uncertainty of healthcare use, the insurance risk, and on the consideration of the underlying incentives of a payment system. For example, if a payment system was designed so that over time there were opportunities to either manipulate game or whether they would lead to a less stable future for the Oregon Health Plan. Again, it was not... this is a bit of an academic exercise. It is in today's world, but it's not necessarily a recipe or a cost containment guidebook. It's more of a statement of different approaches. And then as I transition from the beginning of these first six slides to Steve's presentation, we'll switch more into how they would relate to today's healthcare environment. One of the first things we did on slide three was come up with a list of goals or criteria from which we would evaluate the alternatives that we were going to devise. This is a list of them, and I'll say a few words about each of these. There's one noticeably missing, and I've grabbed this list from the executive summary. In the full body of the report, we spend a fair amount of time focused on another goal or criteria, which is important to the Oregon Health Plan, but somewhat not important to our comparison of options. And it's based on the original language for the Oregon Health Plan states that providers shall receive the cost of providing services. So we discussed it in our report. It's a key criteria for Oregon Health Plan reimbursement. And to a certain extent, we assess the options we've developed with respect to how well you could measure the costs or the reimbursement. But because we're not focused on the funding of the Oregon Health Plan, but more how to distribute the funding, that criteria is not differential among our alternatives, if I said that clearly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenland.
I love equity. You know, we're all for equity. But there are lots of definitions of equity, to each according to their needs, from each according to their ability to pay, or as a form of equity, or a variety of other ones. Did you, besides putting the words down because they sounded nice as a criterion, did you really discuss what version of equity you mean?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Westland, we did try to, and there are descriptions in the full body of the report that put a little more flesh around these names of criteria. A fair amount of the overlay we used had to do less with sort of a social approach to define equity and more toward a mathematical one. So, for example, equity among providers was we considered methods that had the state closer to the setting of provider fees to be more equitable, not because the state will be necessarily doing a better job of setting equitable fees, but because the state will be closer to the setting of them. And so if the state is held accountable for equity among providers, we felt that methods where the state was closer to setting those fees would be more equitable.
If I can follow up just a little bit. But I guess what I was groping for in this is, do you mean equity in this case between St. Vincent's Hospital and Good Samaritan Hospital? Or are you talking about equity, say, between, as comparing physicians to hospitals or pharmacies to home health agencies or something? I mean, is it that kind of equity, or is it equity within a class?
More the latter.
Equity within a class.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, more the physician versus hospital.
Treat physicians fairly compared to treating hospitals.
Right.
That's
and
a
in
complicated
our,
form of equity, isn't it?
In our key stakeholder interviews, we heard quite a bit about that type of equity, how much of the limited healthcare dollar is being sliced for drug versus physician versus hospital. There was also consideration of some within class equity issues, but the larger issue was across.
You want to follow up?
Well, I'll be treated fairly if I get more. Is that the form of equity we're talking about here? I mean, I've never heard anybody say equity demands you give me less money and give that money to somebody else as an argument for equity.
Representative Greenlick, Chair. I'll be treated fairly if I've been given more is paraphrasing of what we heard in our key informant interviews.
We had something else beyond that.
Well, again, we in each of these tried to consider the relationship of a mathematical method to a concept of equity. And so to the extent the mathematical method is blind to the name of the provider, it might be equitable. To the extent that, again, for the alternatives we developed, the real key on equity among providers was whether the state who's held to this equitable guideline was able to affect payment across these different provider types. And I guess you could say there's an assumption that given they have the ability to affect payment and the test of equity at the end, we thought there was a greater chance of an equitable result. I might not be being as clear as I'd like to be.
No.
Let me tell you the concern behind this was the state is held to the cost of providing services and equity among providers test, but the health plans receive a lump sum capitation premium. So to the extent that the health plans could give a lot to the hospital and a little to the provider physician, or a little to the hospital and a lot to the physician, it puts the state in sort of a difficult situation of being held to an equitable standard when they're not really making the distinction across provider types. The plans are implementing equity as they can and will. So that was the perceived problem. The equity among providers was listed as a goal, and the alternatives, as I've said, are not like night and day in terms of equity among providers. All the alternatives do quite well, but we thought that the ones where the state was closer to the payment would result in a higher level of equity.
Well, we delegate the responsibility.
We'll
there are opportunities for inequity in different geographic areas or specific circumstances.
Right.
And I appreciate your line of questioning. I appreciate your answers, because I think that helped clarify a lot for many of us here behind the dais and in attendance. So thank you.
And the last time we really felt absolute equity was when we kicked the plan off, when the commitment was to pay everybody their true cost. And we did that at the beginning, and then we had equity. But we moved away from equity as soon as we didn't have enough money, and that's been a major source of discomfort from probably 1997 or 1998 on.
Yeah, we heard similar comments in our interviews. And although we weren't charged with testing the adequacy of funding of the Oregon Health Plan, I can say that many of the people we spoke to felt as if their payments had not kept pace.
Yeah, Simon and Garfunkel wrote a song about that.
Slip sliding away.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
And thank you.
Moving to the next one, equity among plans. This is largely around the fact that not all plans attract the same type of members, and some members are sicker and some members are less sick. Although we didn't formally evaluate the current methodology, there are a series of factors in the current method that adjust for a plan's population. If they're older, the plan gets greater reimbursement. There are geographic adjustments and others. So again, from a mathematical or a actuarial or a formula approach, we tried to rate which of these alternatives did the best job of dialing in the payment for the health risk and the underlying cost of the different plan populations. And I guess when we get to the alternatives, I'll probably mention that again more. The adaptive budget constraints was a pretty simple one. We wanted to sort of assess which of these methods took less time in the event of some budget crisis or some big problem, which ones were sort of more amenable to adjustment to adapt to real-world problems. The fourth one, maintain or increase participation in managed care. The additional thinking on that was which of these methods would allow more people to have some level of management, some level of utilization, medical management programs. So it was not interpreted. You could read this to say which method has the strictest managed care. When we did our evaluation, we focused more on which method was able to increase participation in something that would be more managed than today. We assessed the simplicity, and we added this word transparency of the method. Simplicity came from the House bill. But in our discussions, we realized that many of the stakeholders were less interested in something that was simple. They realized there are simplicity and accuracy trade-offs. They were more interested in being able to see through it, being able to see every step of the method, maybe a reconciliation at the end. So we tried to assess the alternatives along that dimension as well.
James, let me interrupt. Can all you folks in the back hear, or does he have to get a little closer to the microphone? We doing okay?
Good.
Yeah, I think we're good.
I'll try. Is that better? Thank you. The next one was simply actuarial sound rates. This, again, some of these are, and really all of them in a certain sense, are our judgment about these, and our process of judgment included professionals from various disciplines in our firm. Actuarially sound rates is a criteria that for many might not be the highest priority, but it's simply meant to represent whether other actuaries or the federal government would consider the rating method appropriate. We wanted the rates to be, or the Oregon Health Plan to be stable over time, and so we assessed these methods on whether they would have a consistent and sort of stable future. Provide incentives for efficiency and quality was another one where there are some methods that might be relatively easy to implement, but there aren't incentives for providers to necessarily do a better job over time or perform better and more appropriate service. We wanted our methods to be reasonable compared to other states. And again, someone would think about going through and putting a weighting on each criteria. We're not implying that these are in priority order. We just have a list of criteria. We wanted to be effective for all Oregon Health Plan populations. The next one I think is interesting. Compatible with the prioritized list. Roughly speaking, the prioritized list is a unique feature of Oregon's system. And roughly speaking, most healthcare data analysis and work is not very similar to the prioritized list concept. However, one of our alternatives, labeled the ETG approach that I'll talk more about, is based on some similar underpinnings, and we thought that was worth calling out. And the last one is administratively feasible. This is a pretty hard one to judge because it considers both administration at the state level, at the plan level, the provider level. But we took a crack at comparing the alternatives we developed against each other on that criteria. The next slide is an overview, and I was going to spend a couple minutes on the six alternatives we developed. I hope you can read this okay. It's the big arrow with fully insured, partially insured, self-insured on the left. What we're trying to demonstrate here is that there's a continuum of sort of risk ownership, insurance risk ownership. And I'll start at the top where the state essentially does not have insurance risk. The state still has the risk of more enrollees or fewer enrollees and, you know, all kinds of other risks. But in terms of member having an unusually expensive illness or a bad flu season, you know, that's all currently, those risks are held by the health plans now. So the first alternative is relatively close to the current method. It calculates a insurance premium prospectively, a capitated plan premium based on utilization and unit costs. So we would take the number of services and a reasonable cost per service and develop a rate per health plan. That is a relatively general description, and I'd say that many states use some variety on this theme based on encounter data to come up with fair premiums. I don't think I have much more to say about that one because it's not too far away from what we're doing in the state now. The next one is similar in that it's a fully insured approach. The plans would still receive a monthly payment, but just as you might buy broccoli by the pound or by the piece at the store, it's trying to change the unit of reimbursement. And so instead of being concerned about the cost per service, like $30 for an office visit, this one is more concerned with the cost per episode. And ETG stands for Episode Treatment Group. It is a different kind of a healthcare coding scheme. And so, for example, something like sinusitis without surgery would be an example of an ETG. And to some extent, by having an average cost per sinusitis episode, you have a little bit more of a solid denominator or a little bit more of a solid cost per what statistic. You'll see if you read the report of the towards the end of the executive summary, there's a grid of the criteria and the alternatives. And the ETG alternative scores pretty highly in things like good incentives. If providers get this information, they learn that they could be outliers, they could improve their performance. So the ETG is somewhat of an elegant improvement in reimbursement. It's also likely to be hard to implement. It is not in common use. More and more commercial employers are looking at this technology to come up with better networks of physicians, but that's an alternative that, although on our list, is farther in the future than some others. The next one is equally out there. Loading fees by geographic region is one where the state still wouldn't have the insurance risk, but the goal of this approach is to transfer the risk to actually not health plans, but to the providers. And the concept is a little convoluted. Essentially, you would pay, you would set a budget, let's call it $200, and you'd start paying providers $50 a visit for the first 3 months, and you'd see if you were meeting your budget, and if you were, you'd keep on paying at the current fee schedules. If you weren't, you would reduce your fee schedules until you were meeting your budget, sort of a global budgeting approach. And of course, if you found that the physicians were performing more efficiently, doing a better job with less resources, the fee schedules would go up over their starting point. So again, it's fully insured, but with a twist that the provider community would accept the risk. Again, I need to say that's another pretty big implementation. This is not unprecedented. It's got components that are similar to a successful program in Minneapolis called the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, but it is not something that's happening in a majority or a minority of states at this time. The next grouping is what we call partially insured. And really, these are two variations on a theme, although I guess the subtleties between the two are important. Carving out diagnostic conditions is a little more targeted at plan equity. There's a feeling that's probably true that it's really hard to get this plan equity just right on capitated premiums. No matter how many adjustment factors and no matter how good the technology is for assessing the different populations' underlying healthcare illness burden, it's hard to get the prospectively set premiums exactly right. So this first one would say, let's take some of the tougher areas, maybe transplants or AIDS or some very high cost, not very frequent categories of care, and let's pay for those fee-for-service or some different way, but not try and have an adjustment factor or accept some plans receiving a disproportionate share of those very expensive cases. The next one is different to the extent it tries to carve out service categories. For example, the PCO model that Oregon used, I guess, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, would be an example of this, where perhaps you would keep the professional payments on a capitated, prospectively paid premium, but take hospital or prescription drug and put it into a different funding mechanism that was paid on a fee schedule. So the state would assume the risk for insurance on that section, but continue to prepay and transfer the risk for the professional services. There may be a few points on the continuum we haven't covered, and I think when we get to Steve's presentation, there may be a few more things filled in. But the end point is self-insurance, similar to the fee-for-service program, current Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service sector. This would say that in this way we worked up for the alternative, the health plan would provide the medical management functions and the reimbursement functions of the providers, but the cost would essentially be a pass-through. So it would be closer to a fee-for-service payment mechanism, but with utilization management. Slide five. These are just a couple of the toughest issues and maybe shifting contexts that we found during our study. The cost of providing services language I've already mentioned a couple times. But that's very hard.
James?
I'm sorry, yes.
Excuse me, if I could interrupt. I went back to your report. And I don't know if there's any weighting, and you went out of your way to say, and I appreciate it, that you really didn't weight these. But in terms of putting one or two or three or four checks in these various boxes, I assume you're meaning that particular category, you know, is has a stronger representation or ability to accomplish than, you know, if you had three versus one. And if you, and it went further, and this is pretty, probably not very good methodologically, but I added up all the checks, including those that in the columns that were not available, and I came up with different numbers at the bottom, and then I thought, well, to be fair, let's take out all the categories that were not available, and I, you know, added them up again, and I came up with that the ASO model, you know, where the state takes all the risk, you know, would be the most implementable model. Is that what this is telling me? Interpret this for me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is a logical thing to do. And we did it as we were filling out these checks, but we purposely didn't assign numbers because we didn't want to imply a level of precision that's not here. It is, I think, clear that in this analysis, given these criteria and the way we assess them, that the right-hand side has more check marks than the left-hand side. I think actually a good exercise might be to assign those weights and then do one for one check, two for two checks, and then do a weighted average. And you might find that you had similar or different results. My concern about simply adding them up is that some of these are more important, and some of these are more similar. You know, you might find that a couple of these criteria, even though we thought they were distinct enough to list, maybe a few of them are kind of going the same direction, like provider equity, plan equity. But yes, the administrative services only. Is one that, when considered against these goals, we thought made good sense. The goal of, you know, note that there's not a goal saying save money. There's not a goal. We didn't list the pay the cost of providing services. This is more method comparison in terms of a method that would accomplish these goals. But I'm both agreeing and warning, I think.
This would be very instructive for me. And I'm not. Does everybody have this report? I just grabbed one. Chair Westland's asked this question about this. Could you go across that top line where you had a wonderful distribution from 1, 2, 3, and 4 on checks, and perhaps share with us the logic that got you on the equity among providers to find those kind of assessments? I mean, they are qualitative assessments. We understand that.
Right.
Could you just sort of share how utilization of services and unit costs got one check and ASO got four checks? And
yeah, I'll try and do that, Representative Greenlit, Mr. Chair. Essentially, the equity among providers criteria was judged to be least strongly met for the first two, where there is a full insurance model. And again, I said earlier that this was based on a premise that the state was going to be in charge of determining equity because the state is held to the equity result. So the reason that there's one check for the full insurance model is simply, and maybe wrongly, because the plans are in charge of equity across providers.
So that's not really equity. That's the criteria, is how closely control the reimbursement does the state do. I mean, is that what that criterion really is? Is that your definition of equity?
It's how much the method allows the equity goal to be influenced by the state.
No, it's how much the actual reimbursement is determined by the state.
Yes.
So that criterion shouldn't be equity. That criterion should simply be the extent to which the state, rather than somebody else, determines the distribution of payments. You have to assume that when the state does it, it's equitable, and when anybody else does it, it's inequitable. Everybody knows how equitable the state is in distributing money. We certainly have agreement on that one. But shouldn't that be the title of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the point is the methodology does not specifically say that providers and the distribution of costs among a physician or a hospital would be specifically addressed in the first column. So in that, there is no specific assumption within that rate-setting methodology for a distribution among hospital and physician or pharmacy.
But however equitable or inequitable, the state decided to pay based on the ASO, as opposed to however equitable or inequitable the combined force of fully capitated health plans determined that. This would have four checks for those that were determined by the state directly, and one check for those that the distribution among providers was determined by the cumulative wisdom of the fully capitated health plan.
Representative Greenlick, I think you're making a good point. We had a similar point from a health plan that read our report. They're saying, do you mean that we are going to do a worse job than the state at determining equity?
By definition, simply because we're doing it as opposed to the state doing it.
Again, the context, and it's possible that a different name of the goal would be better. The context we were working with was the stakeholder interviews, where we heard a lot about inequitable payment between physicians and hospitals, say. And so under the current system, where the state throws out a capitated premium, the health plan takes it and slices it any way they want to, there is a perceived problem. The perceived problem then is leveled as sort of a complaint against the state because there's a provider equity problem. And so what, you know, in terms of the process flow, we realize the state can't fix that problem given its current method.
So one, I mean, the four you get on the first line and the four you get on simplicity and transparency and the four you get on stability over time automatically goes four to the state, not to an ASO method. I mean, automatically by definition, and one to a fully capitated health plan. It's not how you rate it. It's the definition that drives the difference between a four and a one.
It certainly is for equity among providers, yes.
Well, I think it is for the others as well. Stability. I mean, I was coping with where Chair Westland was going by adding them up, and if you stack the deck so that one definition automatically gets a four and the other model automatically gets a one, regardless of, say, whether there's equity, for example, or not,
right,
then, I mean, you have kind of defined it that way.
Yeah, I would say that we have certainly had to pick a context, and we have, I mean, what you're pointing out is in this analysis. It is, you know, the qualitative work we did, and it's the way we approach doing it. And given the combination of perceived problems, alternatives, and goals, it does represent our learnings in this project. I would exercise or advise caution in adding up, and I kind of would hope somebody would go to this kind of a chart. First of all, we struggled putting this in here, but we thought that people would deserve some of our judgment about all these options. There's a lot more written on each option in the body of the report. What I would like to see people do is to think about the goals, prioritize them, maybe have a philosophy about risk sharing, and then find the components of alternatives that make the best sense to them.
Okay, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, while we're on that topic, did you all wrestle with the notion, you've basically made the case that something is put outside the direct control of the state in terms of equity between providers, but when it's put outside the direct control of the state, then the market provides a source of equity between providers in that if a provider is underfunded, they drop out of the plan and the plan collapses, if you will. Did you all wrestle or think about that side of the issue of equity between providers, that mechanism, if you will, a different mechanism?
Representative Merkley, not totally explicitly. This was a difficult exercise to boil down and summarize everything we had developed into this chart. I would say that there was a feeling that well, let me just leave it there. It was not an explicit analysis.
Okay, proceed.
Okay, back to the slides. I feel like I'm taking more than my allotted time, so I'll maybe try and speed up just a bit. These are probably things you all know pretty well, but it was interesting to us to sort of think through the reduction in the level of competition in the Oregon Health Plan versus its inception or even a few years ago. And I think there are implications on alternative selection based on a lower level of competition. There are a lot of methods out there that are based on health plans vying to be the low bidder to really get all the members in a certain population. And it was both reported by many of our stakeholder interviews and sort of confirmed by other participants that there is not enough money to create much competition, and that models that were really based on a high level of competitive frenzy are unlikely to be very successful. The third bullet there is just one we heard over and over. The perception is that the overall funding is low enough that even if the allocation system were perfect, everybody would share in a loss. You know, we've talked enough during the questions that the next couple slides where I say priorities guide choice, I think that is really the key. And again, if you have a more noble goal of realigning incentives, something like an ETG insurance approach or the floating fee schedule might be the ones you would logically gravitate toward. If you're focused on provider versus provider equity, the ones that are disaggregating that premium seem to us to be making moves in that direction. We assume that all of these would have care management, utilization management, medical management. It is assumed for all alternatives. We thought it might be easier if the plan is less focused on insurance risk and what they're winning or losing in their insurance underwriting, so that it's possible that a reduction or a shared risk or PCO or ASO might enhance the ability of plans to stay in the game or take on new populations. And then the last one, I guess, it's just another budget problem. Although we tried to rank these on ability to adapt to different budget constraints, I think they're all pretty difficult. It's possible the ones that are more flexible in their administrative options, and maybe especially the floating fees, since they're already designed to adjust to a global budget. No matter what, funding is directly linked to access. And I think, you know, that's probably where we're going to go in the next part of this discussion. So I guess I'm going to try and wrap up and transfer to Steve, kind of move out of the report more into the current environment and what other states in Oregon are facing. Again, we do think that coming up with a set of priorities, you know, and even within these defined alternatives, there are many more components. It's very likely that none of these alternatives is a perfect answer, but that pieces or components of them could be worked into a future payment mechanism that works well. So with that, I guess I'll give it to Steve.
Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, what I'm going to talk through is the one-page handout that is labeled Risk Continuum Models. One of the things that we were asked to provide some additional guidance on is today's environment, what other states are looking at when they are considering similar issues such as Oregon and examining the continuum of reimbursement methodologies. And so what we've tried to do is lay out a series of options that would provide the state of Oregon with some alternatives for discussion as to how that funding mechanism might be done. What I'm going to do is walk through each one of these, give you some explanation for the acronyms that are on here, and then try to give you some of the key comparison points. One of the points that I'd like to make as part of an introduction is that each of these options that we've laid out have particular strengths and weaknesses, and their appropriateness and their effectiveness is really dependent upon the population and benefits that you would try to apply them to. The important point there is the current fiscal situation in the state has you looking at what populations you're going to cover and what benefits those individuals are going to receive. So it may be appropriate that as you reevaluate your options for population and benefits, you come back and look at some of the issues that we've described here and use these as some potential discussion points for how you move forward. I'm going to walk through some of the acronyms so that you can understand them. I'm going to start out at the top, the first row. That column is whether or not there was a waiver needed for this particular service delivery or funding mechanism. Physician incentives is an attempt to describe whether or not it is easy for that risk model to incorporate physician incentives within its reimbursement structure. The next column is the state fee schedule, whether or not the federal government requires or allows the use of the providers to be reimbursed at the state fee schedule. The next FMAP is the federal matching medical assistance percentage. What that is your match rate. Each state has a an administrative match of 50%, and then based on the state's per capita income, you get your match that you receive on program dollars. The reason that's important is your program dollar match at about 60% is higher than your administrative match. Right now, within your currently capitated environment, even though there are admin dollars as part of that capitation, because they're in a capitated environment, you actually receive your program match for those. It's very important to evaluate that as you look at the cost effectiveness of any given approach. Exactly. The next column, MC regulations, that's managed care regulations. For those of you who are familiar with the Balanced Budget Act, there were a number of managed care regulations that were included as part of that. It's very important to note which of these options along the continuum are going to be subject to the managed care regulations. Another thing that I know the state of Oregon's considering is provider tax as a way of raising revenue and additionally receiving federal match. It's very important to note which of these have that possibility. And then last is the test of cost effectiveness. CMS subjects managed care programs to a number of different cost effectiveness criteria. It's very important to note which one would be applied to the individual's options that are being examined. If I go to the rows that we've described, ASO is administrative services only. Primary care case management is PCCM. As James mentioned, you in the state had a primary care case management model, which you called PCO in the past. Non-risk MCO is interchangeable with non-risk HMO. PIP and PAP are a specific program design that's allowable underneath the Balanced Budget Act regulations. PIP stands for inpatient hospitalization, where you are allowed to have a prepaid inpatient hospitalization plan. That would be the only component that they're at risk for. PAP is a prepaid ambulatory health plan. In that, each of these models are what we would consider to be partially capitated. In other words, you're only at risk in the PIP for the inpatient. For the PAP, you're only at risk for the ambulatory. And the last is full risk MCO, again interchangeable with full risk HMO. The last acronym that we have not defined is UPL. That's upper payment limit. That's a specific federal requirement for cost effectiveness. We also have included on here SPA, which is defined at the bottom, which is a state plan amendment. What we're trying to convey with this information is there are a number of potential options along a risk continuum that the state could consider. And as you evaluate them, you need to look at what you're trying to accomplish with the implementation and change from your current reimbursement structure. And when I say current, I mean not only your prepaid capitated health plans within the Oregon health plan model, but also your fee-for-service environment. So the idea being that you would evaluate the ability of these options to help move you forward against some of the administrative constraints that we've laid out here. I think one of the points that really does need to be reiterated is you can see this table's not filled out completely. As states are examining alternatives to full-risk HMOs or full-risk MCOs, what they've done is they've gone to CMS for guidance, and what they've found is that CMS is not prepared to provide them with
directives that lay out clear instructions as to how to implement some of these options within this continuum. And so we actually have question marks. For instance, non-risk MCO, if you go to provider tax, we've asked CMS, if we were to implement a non-risk MCO, would you allow us to include a provider tax and would it be federally matchable? And they've said, we'll take that question under advisement. And they continue to say that within the next 60 to 90 days, there will be direction provided to the states on the question of this risk continuum. Anything short of full risk all the way down to fee-for-service. Unfortunately, we've had that conversation for about the last 9 months, and the direction continually remains 60 to 90 days out. So we can't give you a definitive answer.
Steve, could I interrupt just for a second, and maybe if you could, of these different models, is there like one state that's sort of doing the stellar in each of those categories? Or?
Absolutely, Vice Chair March and members of the committee. If you had to look at ASO, there currently is a very large-scale ASO example in the state of Tennessee. They had a fully capitated environment, and the health plans felt as if the program was not funded on an actuarially sound basis and petitioned the state to change their contractual relationship to ASO. And currently, the way that is defined in Tennessee is that the health plans are allowed to pay the fee schedule that was in place at the time they were fully capitated. That fee schedule was frozen and can only be changed upon approval by the state, and the HMO would have to petition the state to get a change. PCCM is actually, there are a number of examples. The one that the one state that is most often referred to in a PCCM example is Arkansas. Arkansas is primarily using the PCCM. The idea from a PCCM model is that it's a primary care physician as a gatekeeper model, but it has a number of variations, as does ASO. One of the important points is, while we may be able to agree upon common definitions for ASO or PCCM, and that's one of the difficulties that we have in our conversations with CMS, there is no common definition for an ASO or for a PCCM at the federal level. For non-risk MCO, actually within the state of Maryland, they had a non-risk MCO arrangement because a health plan failed, and they were able to bring in an administrator who was willing to administer that MCO's lives, but only in as much as they were not going to be placed at risk. So they had all of the components associated with an MCO or an HMO, but had none of the risk. Interestingly enough, the administrator of that program petitioned at the end of their contract to have their contract changed back to full risk retroactively because they would have made substantially more money as a full risk MCO than they would had as a non-risk MCO. The PIP and the PAP are so new that while there have been examples in the past, there are no current examples that specifically meet these definitions, but a number of states have done partially capitated health plans where you would have a health plan that was not at risk for hospital inpatient. They're only at risk for the physician services or the pharmaceutical services, for say. And then full risk MCO exists currently within Oregon. As you walk through this continuum, one of the things that's very important to note is while we've artificially delineated five waypoints along this continuum, the pieces and parts are very interchangeable, and so they require a very clear discussion of what you are describing when you say, we would like to examine an ASO in Oregon And when we mean that, here's what we mean from a fee schedule definition, here's what we mean from a risk definition, here's what we mean, is it full risk, partial risk, is there any reconciliation, all those different points. I mentioned that CMS has not provided clear definition. The reason they have not provided clear definition is we at any given moment, Mercer and Government Human Services, which is a subset of Mercer's human resources consulting, we consult to about 30 different Medicaid programs on a nationwide basis. And approximately a dozen of those states are asking us about the possibility of some kind of change in the risk and reimbursement methodology. On their behalf, we've approached CMS with such a wide range of interest. CMS is very reluctant to allow one-off kinds of approvals. And so they're waiting until they can come up with a recommendation for a single approach and a definitive answer.
Okay, thank you. So did you want to go through any more here?
Yeah. Actually, Vice Chair, I would like to talk about some of the very specific challenges associated with each one. I won't go through each of the columns, but I will try to address each one of the rows. From our conversations with CMS, the major challenge associated with ASO is that if you use the term ASO, CMS has instructed us in informal conversations that while you do not need a waiver, what you do need to guarantee is that whomever you pay to be your administrative services vendor, they cannot make direct payments to the provider. That the reimbursement under an ASO arrangement would need to be from the state directly to the provider. Representative Greenlick and Vice Chair March, exactly. The check would need to come from the state and go directly to the provider. It's a very important point because the typical arrangement that you have with your HMOs, you're cutting a capitation check to your HMOs. Your HMOs are paying their providers directly. It would require administrative changes in your relationships with your HMOs if you were to enter into what is strictly defined as an ASO. The next,
Representative Greenlee.
Individual provider. So this is back to the old fee-for-service way where there's a provider.
Vice Chair and Representative Greenlee, it would have a number of similarities to the previous arrangement under fee-for-service and, in fact, current arrangements for your fee-for-service populations. Under PCCM, the issue there is while you can...
Go ahead, Robert.
Need to rate that very high in administrative feasibility on that other chart.
Vice Chair March and Representative Greenlick, the administrative feasibility, as James had mentioned previously, includes not only the state's administrative feasibility, but also the MCO as well as the provider feasibility. It is a conglomeration of the major stakeholders within there and its administrative feasibility. The thought that the payment would need to go directly from the state to the provider is something that's currently happening within your fee-for-service system, and so a mechanism already exists. Where you would need to find some creativity would be if you were to choose to have the MCO adjudicate the claim, how would the remittance advice flow to the state, and then how would the state verify that it was appropriate that claim would be paid so that it could actually cut the check?
Go ahead.
Under PCCM, the primary issue for PCCM that we're seeking clarification on is would the managed care regulations be applicable? And one of the challenges is, as the Balanced Budget Act and the language and the managed care regulations that were crafted to try to meet the legislative intent associated with the Balanced Budget Act, it did not consider the discussions that are going on today and this variations on the theme of shifting risk between and among the state and its various providers. And so CMS can't give us clear guidance. One of the other points that we're not quite certain about is, while CMS has allowed enhanced PCCM models where they included multiple providers so that it was not only physicians, individual physicians, but also hospitals and a group of care, we're not certain how extensive CMS would allow that under the PCCM regulations and whether they would require adherence to the managed care regulations or, in fact, even go beyond that and ask for other requirements such as a waiver, which under PCCM currently you don't need. For a non-risk MCO, the primary differentiator here that we think distinguishes it from ASO and PCCM is we think it affords the state the ability to use the MCO's fee schedule. It's a very important distinguishing factor because as James went through and did some of the stakeholder interviews with the report on alternative funding mechanisms, what the health plans told us was a very important differentiator in their ability to bring networks to the table was their ability to customize their fee schedule on a local basis. In our preliminary discussions with CMS, they believe it would be allowable for a non-risk MCO to use their own fee schedule. That potentially does play very well with your desire to improve access to care and quality of care, but it presents a challenge from the perspective of the state's ability to control something that it's at risk for, meaning the ultimate cost of services, yet it's using another vendor's fee schedule. The other piece that's challenging is under what authority would CMS allow a non-risk MCO to operate? Do you need a state plan amendment? Do you need a waiver? And we're, frankly, we're not quite certain. I mean, CMS has not provided guidance. Additionally, we're not sure how CMS would evaluate it from a cost-effectiveness perspective. We don't believe it would be actuarial soundness under the Balanced Budget Act. We believe it would be under prior, older upper payment limit, which would be a comparison against an artificial fee-for-service constraint. PIP and PAP, as I mentioned earlier, it's not clear how those would be operationalized, and so I can't give you much guidance on those. And then full-risk MCO, you're clearly familiar with those and how they operate. Again, what I'd like to wrap up on is a number of other states are examining this. Unfortunately, the only large-scale example that have implemented some iteration alternative reimbursement mechanism was the state of Tennessee in the 10-care program. It doesn't provide states much in the way of guidance because it operates under an 1115 waiver and therefore was an individual negotiated deal specific to Tennessee. That's good news and bad news. Sometimes you don't want to have guidance from CMS in as much as if they don't have a specific prohibition against it, you can negotiate an individual one-off deal. The bad news is you may have to negotiate an individual one-off deal and you're not quite sure whether or not they'll allow you to do it. And so I think our final point is as you go through and look at your options, you need to realize that each one of these points is potentially negotiable and will therefore take you a great deal of time and effort to potentially come up with a final plan design and program design that you can actually move forward with, thus causing you a substantial amount of time in terms of actual implementation. And as you go through and look at each one of those individual options, you need to recognize that while you may be able to iron it out from a contractual perspective, you also have to build in time operationally for OMAP to actually administer the program.
how Tennessee's working under 1115 waiver, and how long did it take them to go through the process, or did they go through their process under the old HICFA days?
Vice Chair March, actually, they spent about 18 months negotiating with CMS over the individual terms of that transition to ASO. And the reason, there are a number of reasons why it took so long, not the least of which is it was not unanimous necessarily among their health plans as to whether or not they wanted to go to this ASO arrangement. In addition, if they decided to go to ASO, as I said, you have to negotiate the individual components of it. And that's a very complex and time-consuming process. Then you have to get CMS to approve it.
So it might be more helpful to have the plans along with you.
Absolutely.
Vice Chair March and members of the committee, one other comment on the ASOs. For the most part, every state that's been thinking about moving to an ASO-type relationship, when they've got a full risk program in place, it's because they felt like they had to, that there was fear that their plans would not renew their contracts, reimbursement wasn't enough. There were other issues driving it. There's probably not one state at this point that would operate a successful full risk managed care program and say, I don't want to do that anymore. I think ASO is for me. So I think an important point to note is that in thinking about it, you don't want to get rid of your full risk managed care programs because in some instances, pieces of that are working well for you. So you really probably want to take the time to identify what's working well right now, keep those intact. And as Steve mentioned, there's bits and pieces of these that you can take for different approaches. So maybe for your AFDC-type populations, those that the plans are comfortable with, that know how to manage well, those stay in the program they're in. Because by and large, most states, I think, would still conclude that that's a good way to manage Medicaid recipients. However, when you start looking at some of the expansion populations, I wouldn't blame a health plan for being a little bit reluctant to take them on. There are definitely cases or examples across the country where you expand into different populations or new groups and the experience isn't what you thought it'd be, and 9 times out of 10 it generally tends to be higher than lower. So ASO can be a really good tool if you're trying to transition, if you have a population you don't know what to do with, or if you're not sure what kinds of benefits you're going to be providing. Then ASO could be an interim measure to say, well, we'd like to get these populations into managed care, but we don't yet know what they're really going to cost. We don't really have good data. The plans are a little bit reluctant to take them on. Or maybe there's other unique characteristics, like maybe we don't have defined network requirements for them yet. Those are the kind of populations you might want to consider saying, okay, we'll move them into an ASO for a period of time and then reevaluate. And maybe over time you move those groups into partial risk-sharing approaches, and then maybe into full risk. Or maybe you decide that it's the kind of population that can't be managed. The reason states got more serious looking at the ASO was because, obviously, with budget pressures right now, states have concluded that they can't afford to do nothing when it comes to the populations in fee-for-service. Most states have large fee-for-service populations still, and most of those populations are virtually unmanaged. So the one conclusion the states share is you have to do something, so then the question is what? And so I think maybe the caution note is don't destroy things that are working well, but maybe use those and figure out how you can sort of, you know, piggyback on what is working well.
Thanks, Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple of questions. I'm sorry we had to leave the room to have sort of a sub-meeting on some things that are kind of running right now. I don't know if there's a discussion about how you would go about or suggest we go about setting capitation rates. It's something we're struggling with here in this state. And getting good capitation rates that are meaningful are not easy to do. We get something from PricewaterhouseCoopers, and we compare what the rate was set at 2 years later, and some of the rates are too high and some of the rates are too low, and it's significantly too high and too low in different areas. What's been your experience, if you've had any, in looking at actuarially set rates or rates set by any group that's trying to set the capitation rates?
Yeah. Vice Chair March and Representative Bates, what we are the actuarial consultants to probably 20 to 25 Medicaid programs right now. And what we recommend states do when they set their rates is they actually use 3 points of data. They use encounter data, they use financial data, and then they use utilization data. And the three points of the triangle have different time frames associated with them. Encounter data tends to be the oldest data. It can be two or three, or even by the time you're projecting out for future rates, 4 years old. Financial data usually is about a year or two more recent than the encounter data. And then the top of the point is utilization information. What we recommend for accurate capitation rates is you use a base of your encounter data because it is the most detailed information. You supplement it with very detailed financial information that is broken out by line of business, category of service, and aid category, all of the differentiators that you use within your rate setting, and then you supplement it with the most recent utilization information you can get. The reason we recommend you use those multiple waypoints is as the treatment and practice patterns change from encounter data, you have other pieces of information to see which direction they're going. We feel like it gives you more timely, more accurate, actuarially sound rates as you move forward. It is not without time and effort and resources required by the Medicaid agency, however, to gather those additional pieces of information, and I might add, time, effort, and resources at the health plan level. Most states are only in the process of adding the additional components to their rate-setting methodologies.
Well, Mr. Chair, how accurate have you been in the last couple of years if you, for your capitation rates for pharmacy, capitation rates for hospital, capitation rates for physicians? Have you found yourself in a pretty good situation within a few percentage points, or has there been a significant difficulty?
Vice Chair March and Representative Bates, it's difficult for me to generalize, but we have had interestingly enough, our best success in forecasting pharmaceutical expenditures, because the quality of the data there is the best, it's the most timely, and clearly the most accurate. Where we have found challenges is in the allocation of expenditures among physicians, and that has tended to be because of access to care issues. In most of the states that we've been working with, as Stephanie mentioned, there have been concerns about the adequacy of reimbursement, and so as networks shrink and expand, it's very difficult to get the utilization estimates accurate between hospital inpatient and physician, and then among physician between primary care and specialist.
Representative Greenlick.
Can I follow up on that a bit? Do you risk adjust those rates?
Vice Chair March and Representative Greenlick, actually the presence or absence of risk adjustment is a policy decision at an individual state level, and so we do risk adjustment for a number of states, and we also do capitation rates that include no risk adjustment for a number of states.
So Dr. Bates was asking about your precision and your validity of those, and I assume that means in predicting against a future outcome. Do you find that when you risk adjust them using something like the episode model or some other model, it increases your ability to predict accurately?
Vice Chair March and Representative Greenlick, theoretically, the inclusion of risk adjustment does substantially increase your ability to predict. The reason I say that theoretically is, practically speaking, there are a number of other factors that have a very large impact upon the accuracy of a rate-setting methodology that are not within the control of a risk adjustment model. And so they are,
like probability.
They're equally as important. And so states that have made the policy decision to go to risk adjustment have done so because of perceived inequities between and among health plans. And as one of the representatives mentioned earlier, it is only perceived as equitable from the health plans that receive money as opposed to the ones that have money taken away.
Yeah, that was me. It's just that the notion of fairness, at least on a population basis, and you know, we're not talking about the R-square models and trying to predict on an individual basis, but on a population basis, my experience with risk adjustment in a variety of settings is that it really does improve the precision of your estimate, if not the validity of it.
Chairman Westland and Representative Greenlick.
Well, it's still Vice Chair March. He's running the show.
Okay, Vice Chair March. We believe risk adjustment is a more accurate way of distributing dollars. The difficulty that we have is that the data that's required to do risk adjustment is at a level that is typically substantially above what most states have with which to set rates.
Absolutely.
Stephanie, did you have more to add?
Vice Chair March, Representative Greenlake. I think the one area and why it's sometimes hard to answer about risk adjustment is that most risk adjustment models start off with assuming that the base rate or the PI is sufficient. And so you start off with, let's say, one rate, $300, based upon data that you get from health plans as an example. Then you take that $300 using a risk adjustment model, and then you say, pay this health plan $325, but maybe this one $295 based upon their specific data, and maybe they've got more sick people, they have less sick people. I think, you know, one of the challenges is that in terms of getting accurate data, getting financial reports from HMOs and better understanding on a more real-time basis what their expenses are is critical to setting that pie to begin with. And then if you've got a good starting point, then using risk adjustment to figure out how you break that up among the different plans. I think we'd always say that that's a better approach.
I don't think they do start with that assumption. And for our case, we start with the assumption, here's how much money we have. and then it just becomes a question of, can you more equitably distribute not enough money rather than less equitably distribute not enough money?
Yeah.
Representing Bates.
Well, thank you, Vice Chair Marsh. Steve, I did make myself clear the question to you, and I'm going to try to do a better job this time. So I'll kind of set it up for you.
Okay.
We have looked at the actuary rates predicted for our fully capitated plans and found out that in certain areas they're at least 50% off over a two-year period of time.
Okay.
And in fact, they're kind of about 50% off everywhere. Luckily, cities seemed to have canceled each other out, and so the overall picture was as Representative Greenlick said, inadequate sums of money going out fairly. Okay, the question really was how accurate, not how you do it, but how accurate have you found your predictions to be as an actuarial when you're looking a year ahead or 2 years ahead? We know it's difficult to forecast, especially 2 years ahead with a volatile market like we have in healthcare now, with rates going up, costs going up. But the question is, if you predicted the rates for the next year in capitation, and I assume I'm going to make an assumption you probably predict what the pharmaceutical costs would be for an organization or for the state, what the hospital costs would probably be, what you pay to other providers. When you look at that a year later, are you off by 50%? Are you within 10%? Are you within 5%? What's your... You've got 20 different states you're doing it for, and there must be variation amongst them. But kind of what's your gestalt? How's it done?
Vice Chair March and Representative Bates, I apologize. I didn't get the nuance of where you were going. What we typically have done with our states is we ask them, what is a target rate of return they would like their health plans to have? And then that's what we, as part of our actuarially sound rating methodology, shoot for. And it's a policy decision as to where they set that. We have been what I would say is probably 80 to 90% able to hit within the range of the targets that they typically give us. and they usually are somewhere between 0 and 4% of profit on a 3-year average basis. The reason I say 80 to 90 percent is, as Stephanie mentioned, there are some expansion populations where there are very little data available upon which to set rates, and so those are a challenge. And what we try to do is set a wider range of appropriate capitation rates for those. So what we might use as a typical range is around plus or minus 5%. And so that's where I would say 80 to 90% of our rate setting falls within that plus or minus 5% band. But there's another 10 to 20% where we would recommend a state use a much wider band because of a lack of information or a challenging population or a new population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Okay. Stephanie, did you have anything more to add to the presentation? And any more on your presentation at this time? Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. And we'll call up Bill Murray and Dean and Greta.
Well, do we have to hear from these guys again?
Again and again and again. And
that's why the chair gave the gavel to us.
Sign in, please.
Thank you. My name is Bill Murray. I'm the CEO for Doctors of the Oregon Coast South. I think
Bill, pull that whole
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, you've been here before, there. Buddy. Okay, here we go.
And it's an ice cream cone.
Okay. I just will keep this relatively brief, and I would just like to share my thoughts from the existing rate setting cycle as it compares to the presentation you just received. I think the report that Mercer has presented does a good job of identifying potential reimbursement and rate setting methodologies as compared to the current methodology, which actually takes bits and pieces of the individual models that they've set out before you. I think it's always difficult to go into the detail from the theoretical, and I think that's what you see in front of you is the theoretical. We had the opportunity to meet with Mercer prior to this meeting, and we shared some of our thoughts and got some insights into the models that they presented here. I think the issue that needs to be addressed in this cycle is that across the state, we have a high number of plans, and the plans are very motivated at this point in time to manage to the dollars they receive because of the high level participation by physicians and providers in those delivery systems that exist. There needs to be that continued motivation as we go forward and look at alternative models. Certainly, simplicity and the one thing that we discussed prior is the need to sort out what really are the important issues from the issues that tend to cloud or confuse the rate setting cycle. One of the questions I had asked is a hybrid model, which is what I consider we have now, little bits and pieces of the models they presented, or is a single source model a better approach? And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer, and Mercer didn't give their opinion that there was any right or wrong answer. But I think the issue is trying to simplify what we have now, and by doing that, you concentrate on one model and say that there's always things that are going to happen that are going to cause potentially a plan or an area of the state to be different, but you concentrate on the largest drivers with regards to cost, and then you need to, at some point, say stop and ignore the little stuff that really results into a lot of time, money, as far as actuarial work, and probably the frustration that's existed on behalf of plans and maybe the legislator with regards to how many adjustments there are with regards to rates. So I think this presents a good first step in trying to identify some of the issues there is always the transition between theoretical and practical as you move forward.
Vice Chair March, my name is Dean Andretta. I'm with the Marion Polk Community Health Plan, and I still consider myself a rookie. We did have an opportunity to speak with Mercer prior to this meeting and had a few of our questions clarified, and a lot of our questions were along the lines of the state's role in payment equity among providers. And we too ran through the list of the matrix that they generated and added up all the check marks and found that the ASO approach had the most check marks, and I think Mercer did a good job telling us really what they meant by that. But our comment again was that we do what's necessary on a local level to get the providers to participate and participate fully with the Medicaid population, and that that the field position that the plans have is probably a little bit more strong to create that equity than potentially the state has at this point in time. The other questions that we had were related to lead time and the use of encounter data and how the span of time it takes in terms of getting information in and actually creating the rates. And I think that continues to be a concern for the plans as we move forward, that we get our hands on a little bit more quickly the information and in the rate setting process have better accuracy in terms of the buckets when we put it all together. But those were our general questions, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions you would have.
Steve? Representative Greenlick.
I wonder if you two would take a stab at how you would define equity among or between providers, say equity between the hospitals you have to pay and the doctors you have to pay, or even among the doctors you have to pay. What is equity?
For us, equity means that we still have everybody participating. And we really do. We do. And what we have always done from day one, be it right or wrong, is we have always, to the greatest extent possible, compared that to Medicare. Not that Medicare is the best solution, but it's already a significant driver in every provider's office. And so to the extent we mirror that, at least incentives from physicians and other providers are aligned with an existing payer base. So we have defined equity, or the starting point for equity, as being how does it compare to Medicare. And so we look at Medicare payments to hospitals versus Medicare payments to physician providers, other ancillary providers that are providing Medicare-covered services. A little bit difficult when you go to those areas where you have services that aren't covered by Medicare, and where we tend to default on those is kind of a cost-plus type scenario, so that we feel, well, cost-plus. I take the positive cost-plus approach versus the cost-minus approach. But that's how we have defined equity in our plan.
Vice Chair March, Representative Greenlake, we look at kind of provider equity in terms of almost a constant dialogue, not only with our physicians but with the participating hospital and the DME providers within our area to kind of ferret out, is this affecting them? Is the reimbursement affecting their ability to stay in business or not? We do take a little bit more global approach to payer mix and to equity between physicians in terms of numbers of commercial versus Medicaid to determine additional payments to physicians that may need it to provide us that access that we do need. So approach is a little bit systematic.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, it looks like we're now at the stage of everybody at the table.
Do we need more chairs? Well, these two guys could probably stand. I mean, you know, this is Bill Murray and Dean Andretta starring in OHP, a.k.a. Groundhog Day. You will stay here until you get it right. Yeah, and we're going to have to, for the record, share some mics here.
Yes, that's right. There is almost is equal body here. I think we have equity in numbers. You can always slide over one if you'd like, Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
All right, are we ready?
I think we're just...
Okay. I think we're on a question and answer on the House Audit Committee's report. Who would like to lead off?
Or if you guys would like to respond to anything that, quote, the contractors of the plans said, I think that's appropriate, too. They got to respond to you guys.
Here, Mr. Chair, why don't I give this back? Here.
Get friendly with that thing.
You don't have to ask the chair.
Well, again, for the record, I'm James Matheson from Mercer Human Resources Consulting. We, too, appreciated our chance to talk with the plans, and I think that we see, you know, more things somewhat similarly than divergently. There are a lot of subtle context issues when you talk about these things, and getting together to see if you are saying different things or not is very helpful.
Great. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, I'm going to ask you this question. It's one we've been asking for 3 months. I read through the Mercer report, and I appreciate that. I was especially impressed that they can do a fairly accurate job of predicting capitation rates. After looking at all these models and thinking about these models, and I still go back to putting physicians and other providers at risk and putting the plans at risk to control costs, and I've not been moved from that by what I've read here. Am I missing something? I mean, an ASO model has no risk in it, and strictly is an administrative model. I'm unmoved that we should change anything as a result of this report, other than looking at potentially somebody else doing capitation rates for us.
This is Bill Murray, CEO with Docs. I would agree with that comment that capitation has been a very successful motivator to the individual plans in regards to being inventive with addressing care issues and also with managing costs and managing equity amongst providers, in that we are responsible with making the equation work. So as a basis, it gives us an incentive to save money to spend in other areas that might produce results that were not envisioned, either in the setting of the capitation rates or maybe with regards to the Oregon Health Plan prioritized list itself. It allows us that flexibility. I think the other issue is that no matter how you set rates, if you set a schedule, no matter how well you do that, there are always going to be exceptions, and to the extent that capitation allows us to make those exceptions locally, it's been a very positive result in that we don't have to say we're paying you that rate because that's the state's rate. We talked about this earlier. My providers, although I could say that to them, saying that, you know, we're paying the state rate, their expectation is still as of us as an organization to take that message and say there is something wrong with that schedule if that were the message. So to point the finger and say that's the state rate, it gives us an out, but the next question or the next comment out of my provider's mouths is, okay, then why don't you go change that for us? So capitation allows us that flexibility individually. It's certain significantly limits the risk from the state's standpoint that there's a fixed amount, and it puts the onus on the plans or the community to take care of that.
Thank you for a good answer.
Okay, having said that, and not to, you know, do the crossfire thing, but the James, Stephanie, or Stefan, I'm still hung up on your chart. And I understand, but you look down these things that are applicable, and, I mean, these are desirable. I think you've done a very good job of stratifying, you know, desirable criteria that goes into the formula. You know, I go down this chart, and I come up in any way I add it. I mean, if I add a numeric value, the fee for service, no risk, functionally, scores higher. So, when do you guys respond to that? By the way, those glasses of water are about $200 million a piece. So, so, you know, I mean, you're going a long way to, you know, solving our problems here. I just want you to know that.
Chairman Westland, members of the committee.
Yeah, then we're going to match it.
I think the issue that we would have with that is the criteria that we laid out are not all equal. And so from a prioritization perspective, what we would say is we actually viewed this table as rather than in lieu of full capitation, these would be additional options that you could have. So this is not necessarily a substitution. But we were looking at this as you have potentially health plans who are saying we may not be willing to take full risk on certain populations. Could we come up with a way to continue to get the access to care and the quality of care that your fully capitated health plans have brought to the table, but do it in a way so that you continue to have them and achieve your own policy goals. I couldn't add up any of these any other way, but let me give you an example of why I think this is a fairly important point. ASO scores lowest on provides incentives for efficiency and quality. That's what you've told me is if you're not your number one criteria, it's got to be two or three. It's up there. And so it's a challenge. As Stephanie said earlier, we see it as a waypoint as you're transitioning towards some kind of alternative reimbursement methodology.
And I appreciate you pointing that one out. That's the only one where they actually score lower than the, you know, utilization of, you know, a RUV type model, and quality is obviously important. So you know how do you weight that? I guess, and I understand that's the dichotomy from what we're saying here. Representative Bates' question, Mr. Murray's answer, my question to you. Yeah, I understand that, but I still look at this thing and I just go, hey, that ASO is just kicking the RUV. Tail.
But our primary goal is actuarial sound rates, which it doesn't provide.
Yeah.
Could I?
And I am here to swear, as the Lord is my witness, that Representative Mona Sanderson has never looked worse.
Well, that's what you get when you move from the left to the right.
You move to the left, Greenlick. You move to the left. Mitch, go ahead.
Take care of this one. I think you should also leave room, if I can comment, for this chart not to be right. And I don't mean that in an incorrect context. I think the important thing about this chart is those criteria have some names, and I think they're the definition. We explored that a bit. I think it's a little different than what you or I might use. I think the value of this chart would be for you to think about how you would rate these things with some questions, because I mean this is really an aid to thinking rather than a
quantitative result that says here's the answer. I mean, I don't think you intended it to be done by adding these things up. I think you had a set of definitions that go with these that might be different than the definitions we had. But I think the importance of a chart like that is that it points out you win some and you lose some when you go to different kind of models. And it would be interesting to have a similar chart like this for the mm-hmm. for the alternatives you use, which are a little different than these alternatives.
Right.
And it would be even more interesting to do it, I think, with the alternatives you did. Maybe you could even do that. But I think we could sit here and say, okay, what do we mean by equity among providers? Get some common understanding of what that means, and then rank it ourselves on what it means by that. And we might come up with a very different answer, but I think it's the exercise that's instructive rather than the answer. And it might be useful for you to comment on that.
Representative Greenlick, thank you. I wanted to say that I think that's exactly right, along with the exercise of putting some weights along the criteria. If maintaining and increasing participation in managed care is twice as important, it should get a double the weight. And I did want to go back to that equity among providers where we did spend time earlier. I think that conversation was very good and very important. And we certainly didn't mean to imply that the state would do it better than the health plans. I think that if we all sat around and had a different discussion about who's likely to get equity more right, we might find the local health plans better able, or at least equity as they see it, to keep a network together. But what we were responding to is the current method, which allows for that, still generating a fair amount of discontent among providers. A lot of that's based on the total size of the pie, but it seemed like there was kind of a concern, and there is just an option for inconsistency and plans' approaches to distributing the capitation. But I do think that you would have a fun time, as we did, trying to hold ourselves to a set of constraints and assess each cell, and would likely come up with something we'd hope would be a little similar, but would certainly vary.
Question again for James, Stephanie, or is it Stephen or Stephan?
Steve.
I like those single syllable words. Representative Cruz can understand them. On page 2 of your report, you guys outlined the scope of your work and then were pretty good in saying what you excluded. The first bullet point under what you excluded, I understand why you excluded the second part of that first bullet point, you know, the adequacy of current state funding for OHP. That's certainly not within the scope. Now, I didn't let this RFP, so I guess my question is, was there anything in the RFP that directed you, or was there an opportunity to evaluate our current methodology? Or would you consider you've done that in that left-hand column of the chart?
Our assignment was specifically to not assess the current, but to develop alternatives. So we worked to get an understanding of the current, but we did not. And we started sort of down a track. Maybe we should compare everything to the current. But for various reasons, we were we ended up comparing these alternatives against each other, but not specifically against the current.
Yeah, and I guess that's my problem is, okay, we've got an orange here, and we've got a pear, an apple, a banana. Come on, you're good. You're a farmer. Give me something else. A cherry.
Pomegranate, kiwi.
You know, we've got all these six different, you know, alternatives over here. How do those relate to what we do? Why is this relevant to me? Is what I'm really asking. I understand it probably wasn't within the scope of your work. But my question is, okay, this is good. We've just learned six other alternatives. How does that relate to our decision-making process up here?
The underlying reason for not comparing directly to the current, I believe, was the lawsuit consideration. I think that drove the instruction to us to focus on alternatives, not current method. to use this report and try to get where you'd like to go, I would look at the left-hand column as being the closest and relatively similar. So it's a subtle, another sort of small distinction, but that's the way we had to pursue the report.
You know, that's
okay.
A marvelous analogy, though, isn't it? Because that is what we are. I mean, you can never say an apple is better than an orange. But you can compare which fruit you want to eat for breakfast and which one you want to recommend to others on a set of dimensions. That is a marvelous analogy.
Well, that's if you eat fruit for breakfast.
Well, or not. That's the point.
This is a bad time of year for oranges anyway, so.
Well, but before this goes too far, thank you. Representative Bates.
Just to get you guys off the stuff, I'll get back to what we're supposed to be talking about for a minute. As I looked through this the other night, I tried to put in my mind what you're trying to tell us with this report. And I had a couple questions pop up, and I'm going to ask them again. First, I'm going to go back to the matrix, which is probably the best thing for me to look at. I couldn't quite remember what the seven different options were at times, but I looked through that and thought, where do we want to go with the health plan? That was my major question. And what I looked at is I had provide incentives for efficiency and quality. Obviously, that's what we want to do. And we'd kind of reached the conclusion that was obtained through participation in managed care plan. When I started comparing those two, I found they had kind of contrary values for them. Okay, if you go for one of the models that provide us for efficient quality, you start dropping people out of plants, it looks like. And what I wanted to ask was, you have experience from different states that we don't. We don't have an opportunity to travel and talk to different states about their plans, but you people do. And that's what you bring it to us today. We believe, or many of us believe in this state, that staying inside managed care plans is the best way to take care of this population, both as cost is concerned, and quality of concern and access for those patients is concerned. And we have pretty good experience that is what actually does happen, but we haven't got our whole state on those plans. So the questions are these. How do you get people to get into the plans and stay in the plans? And what is your experience you're seeing in other states now? Are people staying in managed care? Are they getting out of managed care for this population? Are states moving in that direction or away from that direction? And what are the barriers? And what have other states done to get people back into plans or keep them in plans? A lot of questions there. I just want a sense of what's going on in other states.
Chairman Westland, Representative Bates, it's a combination of things, I suppose. But, you know, one thing that struck me in looking at what's done here, there's one element that seems to present a complication here that we've not seen in other states, and that's the requirement to pay providers cost. So I just want to throw it out on the table just to say that, you know, I know as I read through a lot of this the first time, initially not being familiar with Oregon, that struck me as something that we've, in most other states, you really don't talk about as formally as it's discussed here. And so instead what you end up focusing on, I think the direction that I'd say the majority of states are taking is there's not been a lot of discussion, as an example, to compare to Medicare or things like that. The discussions are focused on, okay, we've got a managed care plan or a managed care program in the state. We need to get data from the managed care plans because they've got the best sense of what's going on out there. Now, logically, you'd say encounter data should provide that. And in theory, that's probably true. But the reality is very few states in the country have been able to successfully collect encounter data to the point where you could just use that alone to develop rates. So most states, I'd say all states, frankly, have been forced to come up with supplemental sources, and gets back to that sort of three-point triangle that Steve talked about earlier. And so most states have said, okay, what other information is out there? It's going more directly to the health plans and getting information from them. The challenge here is it's not a short lead time. It probably takes a good year at least to define the information you want to get from the plans. And it really needs to be reported at a level of detail that says, okay, for the AFDC less than 1 population, here's what I've spent on that population, for the 1 to 13. And again, each state comes up with a slightly unique differentiation to how they account for that. But I'd say by and large that's what most states are doing. And when you ask the question about accuracy, I think that's why we're getting more accurate results, is rather than just relying on incomplete encounter data or older encounter data, you're supplementing with more recent data sources. Is it work for the plans in the state? Absolutely, yes. It's more work. But I guess we would also argue that there's a tremendous amount of money at stake to not get it right or not get it as right as you can. So I'd say 9 times out of 10, with any states that we've talked to or worked with in this, they're moving in that direction. And again, these are states that don't have a lot of fee-for-service data that's recent to rely on. These are states that have managed care plans that are having to develop these rates and really have to go to some other alternative source. So I think that's one thing you're seeing. And in the states that are struggling right now and looking at other alternatives like ASO or other approaches, the one thing I would say is, you know, we talked earlier on the check marks in the ASO. I think one of us said, well, every time we talk to CMS, we might remove a check. Because the reality is, it's getting more complicated the more we talk to CMS about it. But I think the point being that states initially said, well, they haven't been able to come to an agreement with the plans. And the reality is what's driving that is there's just not enough money. There's not enough money in the programs right now. So the first easy place for a state to go is to say, we're going to push these guys and let's see how far we can push them until they scream. So all the states pretty much have tried that already, and then they've started to scream. So the next thing is you say, all right, what can we do to maybe more equitably pay the plans? Things like risk adjustment come into play, other ways to say, well, what you want to try and avoid is paying one plan, underpaying another. You want to try and make sure all your plans are as efficient as they can be. Hopefully at that point you've weeded out the poor performers, you've got your good performers. But that's still not enough. So the next thing you're, of course, faced with are the difficult decisions, the very difficult decisions of populations and services and saying we're going to eliminate those. And so those are all the things that states are going through, just like you are. And they're pretty much stuck. Then came things like this ASO, and I think what states are quickly realizing is no matter which one of these models you take, claims are claims are claims. And there's a set of services that you've agreed to provide, and I think some models probably will be better than others for certain populations and certain services and be a little bit more efficient. But the reality is there's kind of a push-pull. And so I think in the end, the important piece is to try and get as much data as you can, set the most accurate rates you can, and pay reasonably for those services. And that's, for the most part, the direction that states have headed. You know, I think a lot of the issues that we've talked about earlier here, you've had good actuaries on contract. So, you know, we all joke that if you put 10 actuaries in a room, you'll come up with 12 different answers. In part, that might be true, but usually within a range. So I think if you look at some of the root causes of the problem, it's probably going back to what data do you have available to set the rates. So I think one important feature not to lose sight of is there clearly is a need to get more information here somehow that's more real-time and more reflective of what's being spent. And at the same time, if you look at these different models, ASO on the one hand, and the reason there might be a perception that it's more equitable in some way, is because I think some would argue that ASO is sort of back to this artificial model where market forces are no longer at work and the state's basically taken over. And so what happens when a state takes over everything is sometimes you have to take more of a one-size-fits-all approach. So it's very difficult then to differentiate among geographical areas or to take those kind of things into account that, let's say, health plans can take into account when they're contracted for specific areas or specific tasks. So I think the other thing to note when we're talking about equity among providers and all those kinds of things is that if you move in the ASO direction, again, you're going to get more and more back to the states handling it all, and your health plans become vendors that are just taking orders from you. On the other end, under the full risk plans, they're responsible. You've delegated the responsibility to them, and so then they have to make those decisions. But I think at the same time, my sense is some of what's complicating that at that level is some of the cost requirements around specific providers and those kinds of things.
May I add?
Sure.
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, you also asked, well, how are they getting more people into managed care? Stephanie addressed how they're keeping their plans. You have to pay actuarially sound rates. There has to be a matching of payment to risk. You have to be a good business partner. How they're getting more people into plans is they're coming up with creative ways to access the health plans networks, but figure out how to mitigate the health plan's unknown insurance risk and balance it against the known insurance risk. And that was the important point of that continuum. You get creative and you say, let's figure out how we share the risk on this unknown portion of the population that you don't know about. When if you were all sitting in this chair 10 years ago when you were deciding whether I go to managed care or not, that was kind of an all or nothing. It was either fee-for-service or managed care. What we're suggesting is this is not an all or nothing conversation. Your discussions with your health plans are finding ways to mix and match parts so that it's not we go all the way to ASO or we go full risk, that you find components in between. That way you can add populations that they have some concerns about, but you can figure out how to address the program design to mitigate those concerns. That way you get more people in managed care as opposed to less.
You know, I heard you answer the more specific parts of Representative Bates' question, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I also heard a more general question in there with regard to what are other states doing in terms of just moving towards managed care, moving away from managed care. You know, what's happening on a national level? Do you have any expertise or ability to comment on that?
Chair Westland and Representative Bates, nationally, the enrollment in managed care is up, but the number of plans providing that care is down. And the reason is there's been a consolidation in the marketplace away from, in fact, Oregon's a fairly unique example where you have 14 health plans. Most states, their trend has been we had, you know, somewhere between 6 and 8 plans, and we're now down to 2 or 3. And that's why they've been looking at these alternative funding mechanisms. There's fewer plans willing to take the risk associated with the Medicaid program. One is because commercial players, having to answer to the street, have been reluctant to contract with a program that has a stated goal of you get 0 to 4% profitability. The other is it's a difficult population, as we talked about in our meeting with the health plans. To be successful in Medicaid, you got to roll up your sleeves and get dirty. This is not an easy population to manage. A lot of the health plans that have exited the market have decided the administrative effort associated with being successful in Medicaid was not worth the potential return on investment.
Can you break that out in terms of the trends with just state-administered public managed care plans versus the commercial? I think your answer went more to the commercial. I mean, maybe that's the question.
No, actually, that was Chairman Westland. My answer was actually specific to Medicaid.
Okay.
There were a large number of large commercial insurance carriers who actually participated in Medicaid who have since, to a large degree, exited the Medicaid marketplace. And Medicaid is now increasingly becoming dominated by local health plans and then one or two national Medicaid-dominated health plans.
How many states, you know, functionally have these multiple smaller local/regional managed care, you know, Medicaid managed care delivery systems? Is this a fairly common model?
Chairman Westland, it is fairly common to have one or two local plans alongside typically, you know, let's say the average is 4 health plans. You're going to have one that's a national player that is Medicaid specific. You're going to have one that is a large regional or state specific. The example that most are familiar with would be a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, and then you have two smaller locally represented plans
in a whole state.
Yep, across the entire state.
So Oregon is fairly unique in having these.
Very much unique in the representation that you have.
So what I hear you saying is we can get rid of docs and midvips and it'll be just fine. Is that your testimony, Steve? Well, you didn't say no.
Chairman Westland,
ultimately, healthcare is local. And in Oregon, you've been able to find out a way to keep 14 health plans and guarantee access and quality of care. Don't be a solution in search of a problem. And that's what ASO is typically described as.
Well, and my question was humorous. I think one of the keys to this is the local/regional intimacy relationship that are built. I think that's why these things are working. That's the last thing in our mind. Well, maybe MidVip, you know. Representative Bates.
To follow, Chair and I think are along the same lines here. I think we have an exceptional program. That's why I was asking that question. I tried to ask it in a neutral way to see what the answer would be. And one of the things I've always wondered about is that our community-based programs appear to be incredibly efficient in comparison to other health plans. I mean, I don't know how a Blue Cross manages an entire state or manages from out of state a population like this. What I was looking for was a comment from you if we really are unique, and if we are unique, how can we move to putting more people into a capitated plan and not be losing? We were up to, at one time, close to 90% in these plans, and it drifted back down. And I think it's drifted down for several reasons. We did lose a couple of plans, and I'm concerned that our capitation rates were not appropriate for a period of time. That caused us to lose those plans and made it difficult with the other plans. So my question is, you've seen 20 different states. How do you compare our efficiency with those states, if you can? And in those other states, are you seeing people moving into anything resembling ours as far as community-based capitation plans?
Representative Westland, or Chair Westland and Representative Bates, I think it'd be really hard to answer the efficiency question in a way. I think what is fair to say is most states' goal was to have something more like what you have here today, which was to have more plans in place, more locally or community-based approaches to health care. I think what's happened over time is that while this is much more common in terms of budget deficits this year, there certainly were budget challenges for states in previous years. And I think how states weathered those storms had a big, big impact on their managed care programs. So it's clear here that somehow 3, 4, 5 years, over the past several years, you've somehow been able to get through whatever budget challenges you've had, at the same time still keep plans in place. I think what we've seen in other states is a combination of things. Earlier on, it looked like to the large commercial players, hey, there's some big money here, I'm going to jump in this. And, you know, they had 6, 8, 10% returns in mind. And that didn't play out. You know, if it played out, it lasted 1 to 2 years, and then states said, we can't afford to pay this anymore. And they were no longer saving money. So I think some of those states where they didn't have more of the provider or locally owned plans, they start off with the bigger players, and those bigger players gradually left. But I think, and the other was, I think some states, on the other hand, started off with just local players, and there was a belief that Medicaid members weren't being mainstreamed like commercial members. And so the belief was that getting commercial players in would be a good thing. So again, over time, over the last 5, 8 years, that's all sort of played itself out, and I think the reality is that it's coming back to more the locally owned or Medicaid-only type plans seem to be more effective and focused on this business, seem to maybe not have the 10% profit margins in mind, but something more reasonable that states can afford. But again, I think when you talk to some states, it's sort of an administrative challenge. Is 14, for example, the right number? Some states would say, no, that's too many. And that's maybe not a desirable outcome because it's administratively complex to manage that many plans. Others would say, and again, I think it's unique to each state, so it's hard to sort of generalize. Others would say, we would love to have 14. Because we think that's going to result in much better access and much greater efficiencies because there's a much better understanding of what's going on locally. So I guess to answer that in a general way would be difficult, but we can tell you that what most states were trying to achieve is what you have here today. And why a number of states have moved away from that, frankly, is because there's been battles as to how much do you need to pay the plans to keep them in the game. And You know, when a state starts off with six or seven plans, it doesn't take losing more than two or three to put the whole program at stake or in jeopardy.
Follow-up question.
Sure.
One of the big problems we're facing in this state is we're in a budget free fall, and have been now for almost 2 years, and it's not expected to end. We used to fund the plan, frankly, higher than we do now, and would draw down federal match for that. We are very concerned that we have good plans in place, we believe they're efficient, and we think we can cover the population with exception, that we're going to have to contract that population due to a revenue shortfall. And if we had enough revenue to bring down the federal match, we'd be in a much better position, obviously. Again, looking at it from the point of view of multiple states, are other states facing the situation of saying we can't bring enough to the table to get our revenue match, to get the money drawn down to the feds that we have had the last two or three years, and there's large sums of money being left on the table that will stay in Washington, D.C., and not come down to the states because the states can't make their match?
Chairman Westland, Representative Bates, absolutely. Each one of the states that we do rate setting for currently have asked us to price out either removal of populations or benefits or both, because they are not in the position to fund the program as they have previously. And so definitively there will be individuals who previously had coverage who the state at their option has the ability to either remove them completely or reduce their services. States are doing it. To a state, everyone that we set rates for. And some have gone so far as actually to try to already enact the removal. And some have been successful. Connecticut, for example, was sued. And a court enjoined them from actually cutting benefits for a population that is considered optional. And so they're in a difficult position. They don't have the money to fund that population, but they have been told by a court that they can't legally cut that population.
Was that a local court or federal?
Who invited this guy? I mean, this, you know, we're having a good time, Steve. I mean, and then...
Hello. Chairman Westland,
extraordinarily.
Representative March asked if it was a local or federal, and I honestly can't remember. I know the state, and I actually have the article available to me, so I'll find out as part of the further research.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Do you have to remember what that population was?
Yes, it was a associated parents for an S-CHIP program.
Gee. I feel warm all over now.
Hey, we wanted to cover them anyhow.
We haven't got to the Supreme Court.
Last question, Mr. Chair. I know we won't want to get out of here.
Who's... You know, I'm feeling pretty good. You keep asking these questions. I'm feeling worse. All right.
Would you like a second opinion?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a judicial system. There's a Supreme Court to come yet.
Well,
Representative Bates.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, facts are stubborn things that just won't go away.
Yeah.
Have other states tried to increase revenues in any ways other than just general funds?
Chairman Westland, Representative Bates. Actually, states are being as creative as possible in increasing revenues. The ones that I'm most familiar with are the provider tax, premium tax vehicles, where they look at the existing federal regulations and maximize the taxing and thus matching opportunities associated with those. We've seen states add substantial revenues via nursing home taxes, via premium taxes on health plans. Any vehicle that is currently legally allowable, they are exploring.
Last question. I'm through. I'm done.
Well, okay. Go ahead. Ask you. I've got one. Go ahead.
No, that was it. Thank you.
Oh, that was your last question?
My last question. I promise.
Well, and I know Representative Bates is dying to ask us. I mean, what has the state's success been with that? Is that one of these things? It's not what you do, but how you do it, and that you dot your I's, cross your T's, and touch your bases?
Chairman Westland, the success rate is dependent upon your ability to craft a program that meets the letter of the law. CMS is very reluctant to approve these what they characterize as funding schemes, and so it is purely based on your ability to craft a program that exactly meets the legal definition.
And is there, I want to say this, a bit of negotiation that goes on? Because I would assume as these states are encountering some of the same fiscal difficulties that we are, they are either applying for new or amending existing waivers, and at the same time putting forth some of these creative financing alternatives. And so is there a bit of negotiation that maybe go on between CMS and the states in a little of this, a little of that? And
Chair Westland, absolutely. The negotiations stem from Administrator Scully has come out and said publicly that he intends to, as much as possible, close any of those funding loopholes for the future. And so he is using that as a negotiation tactic when sitting down in renewals with states on waivers and approval of new waivers.
There goes Muffles.
No, Muffles old-fashioned. I mean,
it's gone.
That's quite a glide slope down. Any other questions for our distinguished panel? You guys have all been great. Thank you very, very much for being here. Some of you coming a considerable distance. We appreciate you. Any other questions you want to ask yourselves? I mean, we've been looking pretty good. Any other business good of the order? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen.